I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way.
If you want to cut that and save it, I think that would make a great intro and outro.
I think we found a theme song.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we explore the celebrated story arcs from comic creators throughout the entire history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, one half of the hosting whole. And with me, as always, is Mr. Brian K. Reese.
That's me.
That is you. How you doing, Brian?
I'm doing swell.
Great. That went well. Good banter. Today on the program, we'll be discussing Godland, Volume 1, the 2005 series by Joe Casey and Tom Scioli, I'm sure I pronounced that wrong, published by Image Comics. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about some things that have happened around the world of comics recently. The first and most obvious is that Wonder Woman has been released in theaters. Now, I have not seen this yet, and I don't think you have either, Brian.
I have not. It'll be next weekend.
Yeah, I'll probably see it sometime this week, but I couldn't get to it.
I fear always the first weekend crowds.
I don't know. I think that's kind of fun, you know, with the, I don't know, just the enthusiasm. I like that sort of thing.
Have you tried to see a movie in Chicago?
I have not.
Yeah.
I'm in the kindler, gentler, mountainous region.
Fear the first weekend.
I guess so.
Allow yourself a matinee a week later. You're good to go.
Okay. So I can't actually speak to the quality of the film itself, but I did want to talk a little bit about our anticipation for the movie. Because I really, really want this film to be good for a number of reasons. First of all, I really like comic book movies, and I want them to be good in general. Second of all, DC has not had an impressive run so far with its extended universe.
Since Nolan's Batman.
Well, yeah, but that's not part of the extended universe per se. That's sort of, you know, that's kind of a standalone thing all its own.
This weird creative freedom thing that they allowed to happen with those.
I know. It worked out 2/3 well.
See, I like the third film as well, but that's a debate for another time.
Yeah, exactly. But so far, Man of Steel had some interesting ideas, but overall wasn't that great.
No.
Batman v Superman is not good. And Suicide Squad, less said about that, the better.
I will defend Suicide Squad not as a great film, but as that film that we will watch years from now on Comedy Central or TNT or TBS, that's going to be like batshit crazy and won't make any sense, but it's the film that I think people are going to watch over and over and over again and just sort of be like, this is a terrible movie, but my God, it's fun.
Really?
I think so. Not fun in a quality way. I'm not arguing
I don't even think
I'm
it's a
arguing just like in the same way that we watch Sharknado or what have you. It's just, you know, Suicide Squad is batty. It makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, the thing to me, I don't even think it falls into the so bad it's good, realm.
Well, I'm not even arguing so bad it's good. I'm arguing so bad it's bad enough to watch again.
Yeah. I don't know. I was just shaking my head the whole time going, what were they thinking? This had a great premise. All you have to do is look at Guardians of the Galaxy and take unknown characters, you know, and put them into a batshit crazy, you know, idea. And it turns out pretty good.
Sure.
They didn't have to work really hard to make this a good movie is what I'm saying.
But Guardians will watch because it's good.
Yeah. But that's what I mean is Suicide Squad. You didn't have to work very hard to make it good. It seemed like they went out of their way to make it bad.
Which I would say in and of itself is an achievement.
Yeah. But again, that you know, Guardians is a singular vision of one creator.
Right.
And it seems like Suicide Squad is, you know, a movie by committee.
Yes. I would argue that Suicide Squad has a better soundtrack than the vastly overrated, over-heralded soundtracks to Guardians of the Galaxy, which is just basically a classic rock playlist. But
that's exactly what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
If you look at the Suicide Squad songs, they're, you know, can you be more on the nose?
But some of them are actually interesting songs, whereas the Guardians of the Galaxy, my God, it's just crapola AM radio 70s music that somehow we have elevated to this level of soundtrack.
No, I'm sorry. It plays better in that movie. I you know, I understand what you're saying, but I just, how many times do we have to hear Sympathy for the Devil when the bad guy comes on? I get it. He's the bad guy. Or the bad woman in this particular, yeah.
For all eternity, Paul. For all eternity.
Yeah.
But we've gotten off topic.
That's way off topic.
Yes.
So all of that is to say, I really want this film to be good because I want this...
Wonder Woman, you mean.
Wonder Woman, yes.
Yes.
I want this extended universe for DC to be good. These are iconic characters. And, you know... I want to see a good Batman film. I want someone to actually make a good Superman film. Once.
Just once. Well, I think we did have a good... I think we had a couple good Superman films. I think it hasn't been in the last 40 years.
Yeah. Well, again, a topic for another day. I don't dislike the old Reeves films, by the way. I just...
Yeah. Well, some of them are terrible.
Yeah.
But the first two are kind of for the time frame that they were made in. You know.
Oh, yeah. I was 9 and they were awesome.
Yes.
But I watched them again as an adult and I say, huh, John Williams' score is pretty good.
John Williams' score, which sounds exactly like every other John Williams score.
Which is awesome.
Or if you like listening to the same song over and over again.
Oh, I think you're exaggerating quite a bit there.
Okay. But to Wonder Woman.
To Wonder Woman, the main thing for me... The main, you know, crux of the biscuit is why I want it to be good is because if it's bad, Hollywood draws the wrong conclusions.
Exactly.
And then, you know, even more than Wonder Woman, I don't really have a stake in Wonder Woman. She's not one of my favorite characters. There's not a particular version that I'm tied to or anything like that.
Sure.
But I do want more films with female leads. I want to see the dang Black Widow film. With Scarlett Johansson. And if this doesn't do well, there's not a good chance that that kind of a film is going to be greenlit.
Because of the way that Hollywood treats and also the media and also comic fandom treats female characters as opposed to male characters, like Suicide Squad could suck, but nobody's going to blame the creators for that. Whereas if Wonder Woman had sucked, it would immediately be, oh, well, you know, female character, female director, boom, boom, boom. You know, nobody ever says, oh, that sucked because it was a male director.
Right. Or people, some will say, well, obviously a female lead can't bring in the crowds. Exactly. Not that this is a terrible story. That's why the crowds didn't come and see it.
Right.
And it's not just, I mean, that's really a big deal. But there are other examples of this. Like, for instance, Deadpool did really well.
Right.
So obviously, the conclusion to draw from that is everything has to be R-rated. That's not the reason that movie did well. That movie did well because it had a singular vision and it stuck close to the source material. People liked that. It wasn't the fact that it was R-rated means you could do some, you know, some gorier stuff and...
Some?
Some. Yeah, and some language and whatnot. But you could make that film PG-13.
And it probably wouldn't have been as good.
No.
Or let me put it this way. Not good is relative, but it probably would not have been as entertaining.
Yes. But the conclusion to draw from that isn't that movie did really well because it was R-rated. It did really well because it was well-written, well-acted, had a good director.
And the source material suggested an R rating as opposed to the source material of a Batman film or a
We don't need an R-rated Superman
or a Captain America film where the R rating might not have been appropriate or in keeping with the character or the way that said character has been written in the past.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's why I'm really, really hoping Wonder Woman not only does well, I mean, because Suicide Squad did well.
Yes.
But I want it to be good. Like, you know, rave reviews, just entertaining.
Well, and I think we're seeing that. We're seeing both, I don't have the full numbers in front of me. To timestamp, folks, this is Sunday, June 4th, so we're in the second day of the weekend, or the third day, I guess, in the way that they judge these things. But by all accounts, we're looking at over $100 million in the opening weekend, and we're seeing a critical response that is extremely positive.
Yes, I have seen some of the spoiler-free reviews, which are, you know, pretty raving. Which is great. And hopefully it'll have a little bit of humor in it so that DC can get away from the Snyder syndrome.
Yeah. It's hard for me to badmouth Zack Snyder right now in this day and age, considering some of the things that we found out recently.
Oh,
but
yeah.
That shouldn't affect his bad filmmaking, but at the same time, it's like...
Well, yeah. I mean, I feel, you know, bad for him and his family, and at the same time, can we take the blue filter off and just have some color?
Yeah.
But that, again, that's something for another day, because we'll have to get into the whole Joss Whedon taking over thing.
Yeah. But to Wonder Woman, I think it's also difficult for, say, you and I to approach it in the same way that other folks approach it, just based on our experiences in history or whatever. But I think, to your point, is that the desire for Wonder Woman to do well, both as a story and critically and box office wise, is as a way, and I think this is part of what you want to talk about, correct me if I'm wrong, please, is that the sort of generic, as you referenced already, the generic Hollywood tropes that we have would place the blame on Wonder Woman being bad on the use of the character or the director as opposed to the storytelling. Am I correct on this?
Exactly. That's exactly right. And like I said, I want it to be good because I like good movies. You know, I prefer to like things than not like them.
Yes.
But I do want to see more of this genre, this superhero genre, with a female lead. You know, I know there's going to be Captain Marvel sometime soon.
Right.
You know, but never underestimate Marvel's ability to cancel that shit. So, you know, if this one does well, we might get to see more.
Right.
You know, both Marvel and DC.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it would be ideal if we could reach the point where this doesn't even have to be discussed.
Exactly.
And that, you know, two dudes don't have to sit here and be rooting for a, you know, female-led character to do well, so that we don't have to talk about whether a female-led female-led film can do well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I would love to see a, you know, how Captain America: Civil War, you have, you know, the two male leads. Why can't we just have, you know, no one questions that. So why can't we just have one, you know, can you imagine if someone doing a film, like a Trinity film, Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman? That would be fantastic.
Right. Yes. Like in and of it, as itself, as opposed to the brief Wonder Woman appearance in the Superman v. Batman.
Exactly.
So do we have more to say about Wonder Woman?
I think we ended that off pretty well.
Okay.
Well, do you have anything to say about Wonder Woman?
No, because I haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
When we watch it, we'll discuss it in more in depth.
There you go.
So we're done with Wonder Woman. What next?
Okay, the other thing I want to talk about that ties into the comic we're reading today, at least tangentially, is the announcement that Tom King is going to write a 12-issue, kind of a reboot of Mr. Miracle coming out in August.
Yes.
Now, Mr. Miracle is, of course, the Jack Kirby-created fourth world escape artist slash new god. That is an interesting character. And I think it really plays into the strengths of what Tom King can do. He's actually becoming one of my favorite comic book writers around today.
Because you kind of came to Tom King, I think, a little bit earlier than I did with his Vision run.
Yeah, Vision was fantastic.
And the Sheriff of Babylon that he did for Vertigo is good, which I think takes a lot from his work in the, I think he was CIA. But I think the Vision is the one that put him on the map, and now he has, of course, inherited Batman.
Batman is brilliant, and Omega Men was one of the best series I've read in the last 5 years.
Yeah, Omega Men is great.
By the way, just Mitch Gerard, the artist who did Sheriff of Babylon, will be doing this new Mr. Miracle.
Yes.
Yeah, and I do like. I think their styles really fit one another quite well.
They seem like one of those simpatico creator groups that you can maybe see as in the same way that, say, more recently Scott Snyder and Brian Capullo, or insert whoever else you want, like where the artist and the writer seem to work in tangent in a very interesting way.
Right. Well, this is an incredibly collaborative medium, and if the artist isn't on board with what the writer and you know, vice versa, it just, you know, the pacing goes off and you don't really get a good flow to the story. These two seem to work really well together.
Yeah. Now, another great example being Fiona Staples and Brian K. Vaughan.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. They made Archie good. That's amazing in and of itself. Now, the thing is about this series is, well, let's face it, Mr. Miracle, as much as I love Kirby, Mr. Miracle is a bit silly. I mean, there's no denying that the concept of a superhero escape artist is a little goofy.
Sure.
Yeah, and the fact that his alter ego's name is Scott Free, for goodness sakes, there's going to be a bit of tongue-in-cheek, I think.
I think Kirby intended, like, I don't want to speak for Kirby, but, you know, I think they're, you know, especially with the New Gods and all of that stuff, there was definitely a level of tongue-in-cheek, or at least the idea that, like, I'm throwing a bunch of crazy stuff against the wall. It's going to be cosmic. It's going to be crazy. And some of it's not going to make sense. But this is comics.
Yeah. That is true to a certain extent. But if you actually read his Fourth World stuff, it's incredibly earnest.
Oh, sure.
He's very, very serious about these stories. And then, you know, I forget the name of the character. There's one character who has skis. He has flying skis.
Oh, yeah. It's, crap. We're going to have to edit this part because I know who you mean and I can't remember the name. But
it doesn't matter. But just, you know, the character is supposed to be this, you know, incredibly villainous, powerful man who has flying skis.
Yes.
And you just don't take that seriously. I love it. Don't get me wrong. I absolutely adore these Bronze Age comics.
Yeah.
It will be interesting to see what the modern take on it will be.
I think so. I mean, I think we've also had, as you and I have discussed, I mean, I think Grant Morrison did a pretty incredible take on Mr. Miracle with his Seven Soldiers of Victory.
Okay. I have discussed it,
and I think we'll probably talk about at some point later. Right. In one of these episodes.
Yeah, I personally have not read that yet.
Yeah.
But maybe for this show, we can do that.
I think we should. I mean, I think Grant Morrison did, and Grant Morrison is so completely suited to the New Gods in so many ways in terms of his cosmic outlook and whatnot, that I think it's interesting that it's Tom King who's going to end up writing Mr. Miracle as opposed to Grant Morrison. But
King's the new kid on the block, you know, right. the big new star, I think, and deservedly so. So far, everything I've read of his, he's knocked it out of the park.
Yeah. So, and I will be curious to see, like, how he brings Big Barda into it, and I'm also curious to see if he is pulling anything from, again, Grant Morrison's Multiversity, which I keep waiting for some writer to, like, incorporate. Like the Multiversity series that Morrison wrote a few years ago, which seemed to me to like attempt to set up a whole world for writers to play in, and nobody's taken the baton yet. So I'm curious to see if.
Well, I always find that interesting, especially, I mean, just because it's Grant Morrison, that DC has gone out of its way over and over and over again to kind of pull the multiverse back into just one, to rein everything in. And then they give a story to Morrison, who then blows it up into a multiverse again.
Right.
As you know, it's like he doesn't play well with the one universe idea.
No, nor has he ever in any of his work from Marvel and DC to Image to anywhere else that he is 2000 AD, what have you. So it's, I think that cat is very interesting, but again, that's probably a topic for another time.
Yeah.
But no, I'm excited. I'm excited to see what Tom King does with Mr. Miracle. If it's just a rehash of the Vision, I think we could all be like disappointed, but I think we're all hoping that it won't be just that.
No, I don't think it's going to be that. Here's a quote that I pulled when King was asked about this version. He said that Scott Free is characterized as a Jesus Christ analog / escape artist who perpetually felt trapped in his childhood nightmare.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. So I think, and I don't know if you've seen any of the, there is some of the artwork that they've released online.
I've seen some of it. Yeah.
Yeah. It looks quite good. And it looks like it's going to be a more serious, you know, serious take on it. Right. I mean, we'll see, but I'm excited for it. I mean, if nothing else, it's different. And they're taking chances. That's something that DC is doing that Marvel is not right
Marvel
now.
Marvel is not taking chances.
Is taking chances and giving creators their freedom to just...
It's such a weird switch that, you know, we had this world where it was Marvel that was like opened up, you know, when they had the Hickmans and the Remenders and the...
I'll even throw Bendis in there. Come on.
We have a Bendis post at some point. You know, I mean, and Matt Fraction.
Matt Fraction.
Where they just kind of unleashed.
Ed Brubaker.
Their creator. Oh, Brubaker, yeah. Where they just unleashed their creators and let them go mad.
And they had some of the most, you know, some incredibly, incredibly creative things happening.
Yeah. And now, jeez, I just, yuck. Whereas I think DC, particularly in the Geoff Johns realm of it, where they're allowing creators to kind of go crazy, which is so against what DC has been doing for so long. And I think that's why they're successful. And I think allowing Tom King to just take Mr. Miracle, a D-list character, and go crazy on it, even if it's not crazy, but you know, I would assume that they're allowing him pretty much complete creative control.
Oh yeah, you'd think.
Because why would they try to like make this continuity? We'll see how it turns out, but I think most of us are like kind of excited to see where King wants to take this.
Oh, for sure. I am. I'm really excited. This is the first time I think I'm reading more DC than Marvel,
which just boggles my mind. To the listeners out there, I am more DC, Paul is more Marvel. So
yeah, and I don't, you know,
our biases will show themselves as we go on.
At the same time, I don't want to get into the idea of, you know, Marvel's better than DC or vice versa. Right. You know, Coke is better than Pepsi and Mac over PC.
But
that
Coke
stuff
is better than Pepsi.
you're hurting my point.
Sorry.
No, the idea is one is not better than the other. People like different things for different reasons.
Sure,
that's how. You know, that's how life works.
Right.
You know, I personally grew up with all the Marvel characters. That's the thing that I have a penchant for. It's not that I dislike DC. I just have more of an affinity for Marvel.
Sure.
Yeah. So stop bringing it up, man.
Oh, we're going to bring it up. This is going to be
this is going to be a recurring ongoing thing.
This will be a recurring theme.
Yeah. But to get down to it, I'm reading a boatload of DC titles right now because almost everything in Rebirth is fantastic. It just keeps getting better and better and better.
Sure.
Whereas Marvel just keeps insulting people.
Well, it's the bro. It's sort of the overriding sort of like, you know, they're all a bunch of frat bros.
Yeah.
And you see that even in their social media and whatnot, whereas DC seems to have a stronger sort of hold on their creators and editors not insulting their fans on a regular basis, whereas many of the Marvel creators and particularly their editors seem to go out of their way on social media to be as insulting to the fan base as possible.
Yeah, that's...
I mean, people can criticize Dan Didio all they want, and he deserves...
And I will.
And he deserves a lot of criticism. But the cat has never... Well, I don't want to never say never, because someone will dig up some quote somewhere. But for the most part, when he is on social media or when he is out at conventions or whatever, he has treated things for the fans as opposed, and you don't see that really like insulting sort of tenor that you see with some Marvel creators and editors these days.
Yeah, I agree. Plus they take one of the greatest characters of all time and they turned him into a Nazi. Which,
well, Paul, you're just, you're not giving it a chance, man.
Oh, I did. I gave it all kinds of chances.
You have to read the whole thing because, you know, there's an end point to this and, you know, everyone's going to be all excited about, yeah. All right.
No, when you're asking someone to shell out $3, $4, $5 every single month, each issue better be freaking good. Don't tell me, you know, the 12th one's going to be awesome. So you just got to buy all these.
Not just the $5 per issue for the main series, but how much more money do they want you to spend on all the peripheral crap? Yeah. All of the, you have to buy like all these extra issues, you have to buy like, you know, it's the crossovers and all of this. And it's just like, and it's, you know, it's like, and nothing will ever be the same again. The all new, all different forever until the next time we have an event, yeah. Marvel.
Yeah. Nothing will ever be the same again until it's never the same again after that.
In 3 months.
Yes. Believe me, I understand the frustration that many fans are having with Marvel right now.
And I'm fine with Nazi Captain America if the story is good. I'm fine with Nazi Captain America.
I'm going to take that out of context and put it somewhere else. I'm fine with Nazi. Yeah.
But the story is not good. And
no, it's not.
You know, there's going to be a Deus Ex Machina that's going to come into play.
You mean Deus Ex Machina? Sorry to be a pronunciation grammar.
And if you edit that out, I'll kill you.
Sorry, man.
Ex Machina.
Yes.
Deus Ex Machina.
Yes.
Deus Ex Machina.
And it's Professor Xavier. I'll fix all this in post.
Cube.
Yes, I know it is going to be, there's going to be some, you know, cosmic revelation, and it's not really him, it's somebody else. I think they missed a trick by not having him punch himself in the face.
If Nazis can't punch themselves.
Yeah, well, I don't want to live in a world where Nazis the can't punch themselves. Have won. No, but it's not just that. I mean, the last Civil War crossover, we had Captain Marvel, who was one of the best characters in comics, and they destroyed her for no other reason. It's just out of spite.
It's the Captain Marvel thing is weird. It's just weird. It just, I don't even understand what the thought process was there.
I didn't even think it was possible to hurt that character, but better minds than I have can ruin things. It's why we can't have nice things, Brian.
Why we can't have nice things. Thank you, Marvel, for not letting us have nice things.
So that was our commentary on Mr. Miracle. That didn't devolve into something else.
I'm going to assume that most of that's going to be edited out.
Yeah, we'll see.
Although I think that is a topic that we could definitely go off on at some point.
Oh, yeah, definitely. There's a whole bunch of subtopics in there.
So are we about to transition into Godland?
Yes.
Okay, why don't we take a quick 5-minute break?
Okay.
Is that all right with you?
No, it's fine.
Okay.
Hey there. Do you like Man Thing? You know I do. In fact, there is nothing I like more than getting my hands on a giant-sized Man Thing. It just makes me feel so good. Wait, you know I'm talking about the comic book character, right? Of course you do. How could you be thinking anything else? Man-Thing was created in the early 1970s to capitalize on the growing monster craze, but under writer Steve Gerber, it became something quite different. Experimental, surreal, and very, very weird. It was something I loved as a kid, but does it still hold up today, 4 decades after its initial publication? So join me, Paul Matthew Carr, as I attempt to make sense of this cult classic and analyze each issue, putting it in the context of the time it was written and comparing it to the standards of today. And maybe you too can come to love the world's second most famous swamp-based comic book character as much as I do. The Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast, a twice-monthly dive into the bizarre. Oh, and I'll probably make some penis jokes. And we're back. Today on the program, we will be discussing Godland, a series from Image Comics that ran from 2005 to 2012. Written by Joe Casey with art by Tom Scioli, Godland is an old-school cosmic epic. It's an homage to Silver and Bronze Age insanity in general, and Jack Kirby in particular. Today we'll be focusing on Volume 1, Hello Cosmic. Brian, this was your pick this week, so take it away, Brian.
Godland, Issue 1. So what we're doing, what I am pulling from is the Godland Celestial Edition, Volume 1, which actually takes up, I believe, 13 to 15 issues. But I think for our purposes, we will be dealing with issues 1 through 5 or 6.
1 through 6.
Which is the collected edition that you, Paul Carr, have read.
Yes.
Yes, and that was our collected edition.
Yes, the collected edition is Volume 1, and it's Hello Cosmic!
There we go. Yeah, which is great. I would also recommend the Celestial Editions, which is 3 nice oversized hardcovers. They're a little pricey, but I imagine you can find them for a reasonable price. But so for our purposes today, we'll be discussing the first sort of trade paperback collected edition, which is issues 1 through 6. To start off with, let's go with issue 1. So in issue 1, we are introduced to the superpowered Adam Archer and his sisters and caretakers, Neela, Stella, and Angie, along with Commander Briggs. Adam's origin story has begun. Discordia is introduced, holding Crashman hostage in the Arctic. A meteor lands in China, disgorging a giant space dog. And to finish it up, Basil Cronus arrives. What does this all mean? Let's discuss.
Well, Adam Archer is, of course, living in the Baxter Building. I mean, not the Baxter Building.
The Infinity...
The Infinity Tower.
I was being silly. But the Infinity Tower is basically a Baxter Building avatar. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
It's a giant structure in the middle of New York where science takes place.
Yeah, on the top levels, science takes place.
Yes.
On the bottom levels, there's some really annoyed people saying, what the hell is going on up there? How much are we paying for this building?
Rents are too high in New York.
Well, how do you want to do this? Do you want to do it as a general overall, or do you want to go beat by beat on this story?
Well, let's go. Let's start with the... So this is our introduction. So let's start with, what does it look like? And the thing with Godland is, it is a complete and utterly visual tribute to Jack Kirby's New Gods.
Yeah, not just New Gods. His that thick, heavy, you know,
heavy lines.
Heavy lines, but just the characters themselves are just solid. You know, they're chunky.
Yes, everything is chunky. All the science is chunky. All of the weapons and the costumes. Everything is like this oversized, chunky. The characters have like these massively oversized fists and heads and bodies. I mean, it's just Kirby, like in terms of visually.
Yeah. And I have to, you know, growing up being a Marvel fan, my brother had all these old Kirby, you know, Lee Kirby, like Fantastic Four and so forth. Mm-hmm. And at the, you know, during the 70s, Marvel tried to have a Kirby style. Like that was their in-house style. So when I look at this, there's a part of me that says, this is what comics should look like right here.
Yes.
You know, like this brings me back to being a kid. So I love the art. And this is something that, I mean, at the time in 2005, there wasn't a lot of cosmic stories going on.
No, Image had not yet kind of moved into like the sort of sci-fi aspects that they are kind of doing well with now.
Yeah. So everything was dark and gritty. So right. This was sort of, you know, very different from what was going on at the time.
Mm-hmm. And I think Casey was attempting to do that. I mean, besides the fact that it's a love letter, he is attempting to bring in new storytelling that folks were not doing at the time. And I think, like with Godland is big. It's, you know, again, we said cosmic, and it is cosmic. It's a huge, giant cosmic tale with like crazy superpowers and crazy aliens and crazy villains, and it's writ large.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Some of the ideas in it are really brilliant. I mean, what the main villain of this first issue is a floating head.
Yes,
in a mechanical suit that just wants to get high.
Right, and that's Basil Cronus.
Yes,
which is great name
indeed. And of course, you know, a Lockjaw-esque alien dog.
Giant space dog.
Giant space dog. Right. You can't go wrong with a giant space dog.
You cannot go wrong with a giant space dog. We don't even have the name for the space dog yet in the first issue. But it's a giant space dog. It crashes into Earth. There's this huge just bananas battle with Basil Cronus like leading like a Chinese army in, and then killing all of the army. And, you know, Adam Archer shows up with his powers that we don't really know anything about yet. And they're these banana powers that, you know, you're like, where does this come from? And you're just like, it's stunning in terms of, like, how do I say this?
Well, I like the way that it eases you in. Mm-hmm. It doesn't just beat you over the head with, okay, this is this guy. These are his powers. You know, it slowly feeds you a little bit of his backstory. And then, you know, it's constant action too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this whole arc is basically nonstop action with some, you know, sort of dissertation in between, which is also in keeping with sort of the Marvel style. And we should state that this is done very much in the Marvel style. I think the first page could be like a 1966 Fantastic Four comic.
Well, there is the very first line calls out true disbelievers.
Yes.
So face front, true disbelievers. So he is definitely trying to write in the Lee Kirby style.
Yes.
Which I have something to say about that. Should I hold off until we get in deeper into the issues?
Let's get deeper into it. So basically the first issue is an introduction. And we meet like Adam Archer's sisters, Neela, Stella, and Angie. All three of them are given very unique personalities. We get a little bit of the origin story, but we don't want to hit that until later on. We have some breakaway with Discordia, who will come into play later. She's a bad person. And we learn about Crashman and all kinds.
Hold on. How do we know Discordia is a bad person? Not by her name or anything.
No, not at all by her name. I like the fact that that Casey is going sort of over the top obvious. And I love the fact, you know, Discordia. I mean, you know that's a bad person. You know that's a villain.
Yes, well, it's similar to what we just talked about with Mr. Miracle.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Scott Free. You know, Kirby wasn't being subtle.
No.
Back in those days.
So basically with issue one, we get a bunch of introduction. We get a bunch of like space and cosmic things going on, but we don't really know where we're at. So we go into issue two, and in issue two, what happens is Basil Cronus, the crazy guy with the floating head, he defeats Adam and the big giant space dog. He takes them prisoner in his submarine, because where else would he take someone prisoner? And at that point, when they're there, we are introduced to another bad guy, Friedrich Nickelhead, whose head is basically made of nickel, shows up via hologram, and taunts Kronos. So we have two villains who are like working across purposes. Kronos is draining the big giant space dog's blood to use as a drug. And Adam Archer is trapped in an undersea concrete bunker because of course he is. We also get more origin story with Adam, where he is introduced to the Cosmic Fetus Collective. And I think that the concept of the Cosmic Fetus Collective is one of the greatest things ever written in comics. The Cosmic Fetus Collective then proceeds to start training him. Adam escapes the concrete bunker with help from a mysterious voice. He attacks Cronus's sub. The big space dog is awakened and freed and ends with the phrase, "I am very unhappy."
Which is an understatement.
Yes. We should clarify that Adam Archer is trapped on Mars.
During the backstory.
Adam Archer is trapped on Mars, which is the rest of his crew has died. He is still alive. And the Fetus Collective, the Cosmic Fetus Collective, have chosen him to be their human avatar / savior / prophet. And the training that they're doing is to take him into the world and prepare the Earth for cosmic awakening. Does that sound right, Paul?
Yeah, cosmic fetuses preparing a new savior.
And only in comics can we have the Cosmic Fetus Collective.
That is true. I do think that that's a sort of a reference to the Star Child 2001, which also was a cosmic fetus.
Right.
So this borrows heavily not only from old Marvel and Lee Kirby, but also from various sci-fi tropes of that era as well.
Oh, sure. We go back to 2001.
Yeah. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, I think Joe Casey is specifically going after these things.
Right.
Not as a parody, but really lovingly trying to incorporate these things. I also just love this dog.
Big giant space dog.
I just, you know, his whole design, everything about him is fantastic. That gigantic head and just everything. He's just a lovely piece of work.
And pretentious as hell, which we come to later.
Yeah, but I think understandably so.
Right. And we do get the big giant space dog's origin later on.
Yes, I think we can skip ahead and just call him what he is.
Yeah, it's Maxim.
It's Maxim.
Yes, the translation to his name is Maxim, which leads to some humorous back and forth involving a certain men's magazine and the dog's name. So, issue 3, Big Giant Space Dog, a.k.a. Maxim, and Adam Archer fight Cronus. Cronus blind teleports away. Meanwhile, Discordia continues to torture Crashman, who has a homing signal in his shoe. Returning to the Infinity Tower, Adam and Stella learn that Big Space Dog, a.k.a. Maxim... So Maxim gives his own origin story, and we get more Adam origin, which, conveniently enough, when he returns from Mars to Earth, he crash lands in Kansas. And
what we also learn how... What is that supposed to be an analog of?
I have no idea. And we also learn how the president reacts to Adam Archer's arrival, the president of the United States. Meanwhile, Briggs orders Neela to send Adam Archer to rescue Crashman, and Neela, Adam Archer's sister, heads off on her own as opposed to following General Briggs' orders.
Yeah, so Crashman, been tortured for days, and then decides to go with the tow-activated distress signal.
Yeah, isn't that weird? I mean, this dude is being tortured constantly, and Crashman is, I think we have like a weird Superman / Batman thing going here. But yeah, Crashman endures like just this vast... Discordia's whole power is that she gets her power from the suffering of others.
Yeah, which is also a great concept.
Which is a great concept. But Crashman just lets her torture him and torture him and torture him.
Yeah, I mean, I get the idea that he's very independent and he wants to be able to do things on his own. So you can kind of write that off as, oh, he just assumed he was going to get out on his own, so he doesn't need anyone else's help.
Right.
At the same time, when you're being tortured for days, why don't you lead with the with the tow distress signal?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that's typical of like sort of the pseudo Batman analog, because Batman would rather suffer than ask for help. We've seen this over and over and over again, particularly help from the Superman analog.
Yeah, I think that would have been, we're putting more onto him than is actually in the story.
Probably.
So far. Yes. So just all it needed was one line from Crashman to say, I don't want to do this, or just, a little thought bubble there.
Right. But it also suggests that Crashman might be an idiot, which we may or may not find out later on in the series. But the fact that he didn't and that he allowed the torture to happen, which just fed into Discordia's power.
Yes. So not a good plan for Crashman.
Right.
And it's interesting that he is seen as the, I forget what they call him, the world's greatest or the world's most popular hero, whereas Adam is distrusted.
Right. It's very interesting that the fake hero, Crashman, who doesn't appear to have any powers and is basically a corporately sponsored or government sponsored superhero. He's a created thing. And he's the one that's popular, and the real sort of cosmic superhero, the one with all the power, the one who is actually actively trying to help Earth, is the one that is despised.
Yeah. He's also seen as an alien.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, that would, if this were written today, you could totally see the analogies being made between distrust of illegal aliens and you have to stay with the manufactured
government
hero.
Yeah, the homegrown hero. All right, issue 4, Nicklehead is in his undisclosed lair, the Funhouse, with his trusty sidekick, Egad. The sidekick's name is Egad. It's awesome. We find that Nicklehead has captured Kronos and has his head in a box with cleaning fluids to clear out all the drugs, because Kronos is essentially a drug addict and everything he does is to get his next fix. Kronos is not happy. Meanwhile, Neela is captured by Discordia as she goes to try to, rescue Crashman on her own. Eventually, Adam Archer arrives, fights the torture bots, and is trapped in a null field cube.
All of this stuff is just really wild. I love the technology of the base and the look of the torture bots. It's somewhat predictable as far as, the fight that goes on. It's a lot of catch and release.
Right.
I think
it's part of the whole sort of nonstop action, which again, I think is a throwback to the non-decompress. This is not a decompressed story.
Oh, no.
This is Godland is basically trying to fill up every single panel with as much crazy, wacky action as possible. And even the moments of internal thought are sort of measured against the sort of craziness that's going on around.
Yes, there is one. I was trying to find it here. There's one, just one wonderful comic beat here where you see this sort of sitting room, and it's just an empty sitting room, and then suddenly the wall smashes through because Adam has thrown a piece of equipment through that wall.
Exactly.
And it's that's a wonderful comic beat right there. It's very cinematic. You could almost see that happening. I'll save this till we get to the end.
All right.
My thoughts and feelings.
Well, let's, why don't we get through the synopses?
Yeah.
And then we can talk about it in a broader context.
Yes.
So issue 5, Adam Archer is visited by a mysterious voice. This is a mysterious voice that he's been visited numerous times throughout the first few issues, which instructs, and this is when he's stuck in the null cube. What is it again? The null field cube. So he's stuck in the null field cube, and he's visited by a mysterious voice, which instructs him to use the, and I quote, instantaneous physical transformation to free himself. At some, Iboga, that's Iboga, is invoked. Iboga is apparently a deity that has something to do with all of this, which we don't know yet. So Adam frees himself. He frees Neela, his sister, and he frees Crashman. Everybody teams up. There's a big fight because we have to have a big team-up fight. During the fight, Adam flies Neela to safety in a sexist moment. Upon his return to the fight, he finds that Crashman has wrapped things up and has captured Discordia. Meanwhile, back at the Infinity Tower, Neela is pissed, packs her stuff up, and leaves. Destination unknown. She's upset because she wanted to do this on her own without Adam's help. Discordia meets with her lawyer, Mr. Tancris. Adam finds out Crashman will get full credit for Discordia's capture, and Nicklehead and Basil Cronus continue their humorous banter.
And humorous banter it is indeed.
Yes. Anything to add to that before we do the issue 6 wrap up?
I think, you know, spoilers ahead. I think Iboga is Steve Jobs. With his new Iboga.
Exactly.
But continue.
Issue 6, Discordia goes to trial. Much media attention. Neela, Adam, Maxim, Stella, and Angie are all, and Crashman are all watching. Maxim gives a pretentious dialogue to Adam. Cronus and Nicklehead engage in more humorous banter. Discordia gives her testimony while Neela watches in the crowd outside the court. Remember, Neela has run away. The Tormentor, who is Discordia's father, prepares to attack, possibly to save his daughter, possibly not. We don't know yet. Adam leaves his body and witnesses the jury debating the verdict based on monetary reasons. So we find out that the jury is more concerned with how much money they're going to make from a book deal than with actual guilt or innocence. We go back to the court. We go back to the trial where we witness Discordia's head exploding. Meanwhile, Neela meets with a mysterious tribunal about her leading a mysterious space flight. End of issue 6.
You forgot one really important piece, is that there are Superman mice.
Have we hit that? Oh, we did hit that point. Well, they become much more prominent later.
Right, but at the same time, look, there's mice dressed as Superman.
And Clark Kent.
And Clark Kent.
It's Clark Kent and Superman.
It really is just kind of a wonderful image there.
So essentially what we're looking at, in 6 issues, we have Adam Archer created as a super being designed to save Earth somehow or prepare Earth for a more utopian role within the global community. We have his sister Neela, who is resentful of the attention he's given, who is setting off on her own path. We have Maxim, the giant space dog, who has arrived on Earth to train Adam Archer in his powers, but also may have an ulterior motive. And we have Basil Cronus and Nicklehead with their own nefarious schemes.
Yeah, they're just supervillaining about.
Yes, having wacky dialogue with each other.
Yes, indeed. Now, I have to, overall, I want to say, I really enjoyed this. There are a few nitpicky details that I found kind of bothered me, but overall, I love the art all the way through. The art's fantastic. I love what they're trying to do here, this homage to the Silver and Bronze Age comics. There's just little things, like the sister being jealous of the brother for ruining her life.
Right.
I find that just a little bit tedious because essentially what she's saying is, I can't believe you ruined my life for crashing because you crashed on Mars and turned into a superpowered godlike being imbued with power by glowing fetuses. How dare you do that to me?
But I think that does, while that does seem a little trite, it does set up for what, I don't know how much further you've read.
I have not. This is,
okay.
I haven't gone any further than this.
I mean, I think part of that is it's a setup for something much vaster down the line, but that's hard to like discuss in this context because we're only talking about the first 6 issues. But the problem, again, with any collected edition is there are moments, there are beats, story beats that are intended to set up.
Well, exactly.
Further this... stories, but that's hard when you're only reading 6 issues. And could Casey have done a better job in these 6 issues from keeping it from seeming like a more trite thing? That's why I'm curious.
Well, it's interesting. I think, first of all, just in the terms of this collected edition, this 6th issue didn't really need to be here.
I think that what's weird is like it's the first 5 issues that I think comprise the first arc.
Exactly. And then this is sort of tacked on at the end. And
the 6th issue belongs possibly in a later arc.
Yeah. But, you know, that's an editorial decision. I don't know why they did that. Okay. Here's my thing, my major criticism of this
okay.
comic. And you might disagree with me on this, but the way that it's written, and I understand that Joe Casey is trying to mimic the style of writing from the 60s and early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I understand that that is, you know, emphatically what he is trying to do. However,
because his other works from, like, you know, X-Men and Sex and various other Butcher Baker and things like that, it's all of those are like very specifically genre oriented, and he changes his style for each of those type of things that he does to give him credit.
Yes, yes. No, I think that I know that that's what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
However, I think it doesn't play well for me. Okay. I'll tell you why. The thing about Lee Kirby is that it's very much a product of their time. What they were doing in the 60s, and I don't think Stan Lee gets enough credit for this. We always talk about Kirby and Ditko and people of that ilk. I don't think Stan Lee gets enough credit for this. What he did was very unique and very innovative. His kind of over-the-top, self-referential, addressing the audience and breaking the fourth wall, that snarky humor that he had, it was at that time very distinctive, very different.
Yes.
And his voice was unique. It may seem really wordy and cheesy now, but at the time, it was really groundbreaking. But
yes.
All that being said, it was very much of its time. So when Godland attempts to mimic that style in 2005, it doesn't ring true to me. It seems a bit off.
Okay.
I'd rather have seen him, you know, a modern writing style, that style of the early 2000s, and let the artwork do the heavy lifting for conveying that retro feel. I just think the humor's a little bit off. The transitions from scene to scene are a little bit too clunky.
Does it feel like you're reading too much homage and not enough?
I'm reading.
Creativity.
It feels like I'm reading someone who's trying to do something.
Right.
It doesn't come out naturally.
As opposed to if Casey was his own voice.
Right.
Taking on the style of like a Lee Kirby, you know, 1960s.
Yeah, it would be as if I'm trying to write. It was if I'm trying to write a story about the 1940s gangsters, and I'm just going, "Yeah, she, I'm just a boss man."
Hey.
It wouldn't sound right. It doesn't sound natural. It doesn't sound honest.
Right. It's like sense. Edward G. Robinson in the Ten Commandments.
Exactly.
Who's your God now? Who's your God now?
Exactly. Okay. Where's your God now, Shay?
Yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm trying to get at. And as much as I love the story, I love the characters, I love the art, the design, the ideas in it are fantastic.
Yeah, the ideas are huge.
But
and some of the character and I would also defend the character creation. And I think like the difficult thing is not giving the visual on Maxim, the big giant space dog. Or the visuals, like we're trying to talk about, like the fetuses, and we're trying to talk about, Basil Cronus, which it's hard to describe it. You almost need to see them.
Yeah, I mean his head, that Basil Cronus, his head is literally floating in a vat.
The floating head on top of like a guy with like a bunch of weapons, and you know, yeah.
And it's brilliant. I mean, I really love that. But
and we haven't even hit the crazy elephant yet.
elephant in the room.
Yeah. Well. Yeah.
Yeah. But the dialogue. I think. Okay. You know what? I think it's probably the dialogue that takes me out of it.
Is it the intentional clunkiness? Whereas you wish Casey had tried to mimic less the Stan Lee. Like visually, we're okay with him. With them visually and thematically, we're okay with them mimicking the Kirby Lee style, but the dialogue is where maybe we're getting stuck.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's what kind of grates on me a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, you could have the Lee Kirby style narration, you know,
right.
The girl, when it opens up with True Disbelievers.
I think that's kind of funny. True Disbelievers.
Yes. No, I get it. I did. I chuckled when I read that.
Right.
So I guess, you know, I think it's just the dialogue that kind of grated on me. It seems so forced.
Right.
It's like, yeah, I get it. Just tell the story. You know, there's so many great ideas and the art is so
beautiful. No, don't tell.
Well, don't try so hard.
Right.
You know, you're doing great. You don't have to force these things in here with a crowbar.
Yeah. And I tend to agree with you a little bit because it's hard for me sometimes, like, you know, I grew up, you know, I think we both grew up, like, on the same sort of, like, I just read through the entire run of the original Defenders.
Oh, it's brilliant.
Yeah. And my goodness, it's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And it also, like, I read stuff like this, and of course, because of the wacky, you know, are you still there?
I'm still here. I was muting because there's dogs barking.
Maybe dogs barking isn't such a bad thing. It's just, it's ambient noise.
I'll do a disclaimer at the beginning. Depending on how good my editing skills are, you may hear a dog bark from time to time.
But, like, reading through those Defenders issues, and, you know, first of all, like, some of the art is amazing, and you always, it's always weird to think, like, if the stuff that we read in newsprint, four-color newsprint, back in the day, including the Kirby stuff, if it was being made now, with all of the technology, and all of the different paper stocks and ways to present, like, some of this art would just be stunning now, whereas we look at it now, and I think a lot of people look at some of this older artwork because of the technology that was available at the time in the presentation, it's harder for people to, especially if they were raised on sort of more contemporary comics, it's hard to see, like, how great the artwork actually is in some of these comics.
Yeah, well, think about, there were also, these creators were also doing, you know, 3, 4, 5 books a month.
Right.
You know, you know, we get, you know, artists today who, I can't get that issue out this month.
Can't finish an issue in a month.
And I understand that this is really hard work. I'm not trying to do,
and to be fair, in any way. To be fair, the artists, they're not making money, like, you know, in any real way on the individual issues they're doing. They're also doing commissions, and they're going to conventions and stuff like that, which is where I think some of them make, like, their actual, you know, bill paying money.
Right. But if you, I mean, look at Kirby. In any given month, he was doing Fantastic Four and Thor and Strange Tales and, you know, just, I can't even list off how many. He was doing Avengers. You know, so all of these books, and he was co-writing them. It was really quite brilliant. And the quality of the work and the consistency of that work for this time is, you know, it's stunning to me.
But then you, like going back to the Defenders, and I was reading it, and some of the writing, I mean, you had some great writers on it, you know, like Steve Gerber.
Interesting because I actually do another podcast called The Nexus of All Realities, where I go through Steve Gerber's run of Man-Thing. Right. That was a plug, by the way.
Yeah. Some of the dialogue, I'm talking about clunk, some of the dialogue is clunky and awkward, but that was the house style. You had the house style of dialogue writing that both DC and Marvel had, like, their house style, in the same way that they had their house style of art. Right. And
they were trying to do different things. I mean, the issues that they were trying to tackle,
Yeah, thematically, some of this stuff was crazy and great, but the dialogue, you know, some of it's painful. I mean, some of it's, even one of my favorite runs of all time, the, like, late 70s, early 80s run on the Avengers with the Beast and Wonder Man or whatever, and I have such grand and loving sort of nostalgia about those issues, because that was some of my first comics reading. I go back and read it now, and I'm like, woof, oh man, some of that's painful.
So that actually kind of speaks to my point. But at the time, it was new and innovative and really, really great for the time. But when you're trying to recreate that in today's comic,
right,
it falls apart. It doesn't work. Comic book writing has evolved since then.
Right.
And we expect different things. I'm much more forgiving of a comic that came out in 1972 and its writing style than this one in 2005.
Right.
Because, you know, I read this and I go, I know what you're doing, but yeah, you should really know better than this. We've come a long way, baby. So that's my biggest criticism. I'm not saying that it's bad in any way. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying it sounds a little clunky to me.
And I concede that point. But would you say, like, thematically and visually?
Oh, visually, fantastic. There's nothing like this in today's comics.
Yeah. And I think that Scully does some other stuff. I think this is like kind of a career, you know, best for him.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's definitely trying to imitate Kirby's style, but at the same time, right, he's adding his own twist and feel.
He's definitely added his own sort of look to it.
Yeah, his pacing and scene structure is very much his own.
And I think to defend it, because again, this was my recommendation, I think that I concede the writing aspects of it, and I concede, although I would defend Casey on, like, he was attempting to write in a style, it didn't necessarily work, say, for you or for others reading it, but as a creator who is, like, throwing all kinds of crazy ideas against the wall, and as, like, someone who has, like, visually attempted something interesting, I still highly recommend this.
Oh, you know what? I recommend it as well. I mean, I understand what he's doing, and kudos to the attempt.
Right.
And it just didn't play well for me, and that's, you know, a personal preference.
Sure.
As I said earlier, people like things for different reasons and dislike things for different reasons. That doesn't take away from the entirety, right, of the story, the entirety of the series.
And I think,
I think it's quite good.
Yeah, and I think if folks are just looking for a big, giant, cosmic, crazy comic that is almost pure escapism. Now, there is some social commentary in it, but it's not heavy-handed in any way. Like, if you weren't looking for it, you could easily ignore it, and it wouldn't affect one's enjoyment of it. But to me, it's like, if you just want something completely nuts.
Yeah, and if you think about the time that it was made, I mean, this was height of the grim, dark, and gritty.
Yeah,
you know, so everybody had to be so downbeat and depressing and Mark Miller type of thing.
Bad.
So this was sort of a breath of fresh air. It's colorful. It's light. It's doing wacky, crazy things. I give it full credit for that. It for the time it was made, absolutely fantastic, and still holds up today.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, hard to believe that was, what, 12 years ago.
I know. It's kind of weird. Well, I mean, it did take them a long time to finish it up, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. Just looking at it visually, I mean, that's a lot of work going into these. So,
yeah. Are these extra? Hold on. Well, it's about, what, 25 pages? I guess that's standard. Did they feel long? Do you get that impression?
That it feels long?
These issues feel long. They feel, there's a lot of story there.
They feel, well, I mean, I think that's part of, like, see, to me, they feel, like, almost thinner. And I think some of that, well, I feel like more happens, but I feel like it takes me less time to read. And that, to me, is, like, part of the, because this isn't the decompressed style. So you have, like, an issue of Bendis's Avengers, which, you finish it and you're like, man, I just read a lot of words, but I don't think anything happened.
Yeah. They had coffee and put on their shoes.
Yeah. Whereas with this, I feel like I read a lot of words and there were a lot of panels and a whole lot of stuff happened. So it's like the anti-decompression. Whereas Bendis, like when I read a Bendis comic, I'm like, really? I paid $3.99 for like nothing happening. Literally nothing happening.
Yeah, I've pointed this out before on my other podcast, where there could be three pages where more stuff happens in that three pages than you would get in an entire year of storytelling today.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, that's not always a good thing. Sometimes you say, wow, that was quick. You just, you know, you just went through an entire year of your life in three pages.
Yes.
You know, it would have been nice to slow down a little bit. So, you know, somewhere there's a happy medium between 1975's throw everything into one panel.
Right.
And don't tell a story in 30 pages.
Right. 2010's Brian Michael Bendis, 20 pages of talking heads.
Yeah. No, I don't dislike Bendis as much as you do, but
Bendis.
But I get the point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's going to be a recurring thing. You'll be putting down Bendis. I'll be putting down Mike Miller, Millar, whatever the hell you call him.
But I'm with you on him as well.
So overall, I think, you know, thank you for recommending this. This was actually on my list of things to get to eventually.
Excellent.
So this gave me the impetus to get out there and actually read it. And I'm going to continue with the entire series. So overall, I think it's very good. I love the artwork. I can't state that enough.
Yeah.
I do have my issues with it as far as the dialogue goes. But other than that, overall, highly recommend it.
So overall, a recommendation.
Solid.
And I recommend it for its complete insanity and the great artwork. And the dialogue doesn't bother me as much, but I get your point. So I recommend it for scope and art.
I'm right there with it.
And so what is your recommendation for next podcast, Paul?
So what I'm going to recommend for next time is not so much a collected edition, but a story arc. It's Captain America and the Falcon, written by Steve Englehart. It is the Secret Empire run, and it runs from issue 169 to 176. And I wanted to tie that in with the current
How Secret timely.
Empire run. I know. It's almost like they planned that. It's almost like we know what we're doing.
Almost.
Okay. Now, I want to point out that this is, 1974 Captain America comics. So it's going to be goofy. It's going to be wordy, and it's, in my mind, it's going to be a hell of a lot of fun.
Exactly.
But we get to have, there's so many great, we get to see, first of all, Black Panther's in it. Falcon, of course, is co-lead on the title at this point. But we get great criminals like the Tumbler.
Are you going to have the French guy? What who's the French
Oh, Batroc the Leaper.
The Leaper.
Batroc the Leaper is not in this run.
Oh, but, how can you not have Batroc the Leaper or whatever?
I believe it's pronounced Batroc de Leaper because he's French.
This is America. Batroc the Leaper.
But it's written by Steve Englehart and art by Sal Buscema. So it's really great stuff. I enjoy this a lot. I don't know if you have that love of old 70s comics the way I do.
Oh, I do.
But we will find out next week.
We will.
We will find out next episode, I should say.
On the next episode of...
On the next episode.
Collected Editions.
An all-new episode of Collected Edition. Okay. And now, look, go. We're devolving again.
Okay. We're done.
Brian, thank you for the recommendation. I really enjoyed reading this, and I can't wait to talk to you next time about Captain America.
But first, I have to say this. You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at the Daddy Elk Productions handle @DaddyElk and use the hashtag #CollectedEdition. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
All right, till next time, everybody. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Yeah, I'm just, I just basically told him, I said, I'll probably pick up what I pick up when I pick it up, but I was like, I don't know. And the comic book, my clerks were like, we don't even know either. Nobody can tell.
I'll pick up what I pick up when I pick it up.
Yeah.
There's a motto. I'm going to have that embroidered onto a pillow.
A thing can only mean what it means at the time that it means what it means.
Do what you do when you do that thing that you do. Do an official goodbye to the podcast.
Oh, okay. All right. That's what we're doing. All right.
To say, thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Two of the most unprofessional people in history.